Tech of Sports episode 71. Jeff Solvinson. Tonight on the Tech of Sports, Jeff Solvinson talking tennis. And Netcast Studio produces great content you can listen to anytime and online. Go over to netcaststudio.com. Check it all out. Tech of Sports is a proud member. Tech Podcast Network. TechPodcast.com. It's Tech. It's here. The Tech of Sports production on Netcast Studio at netcaststudio.com. So it's every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. And you can listen to the show live, join the chat room, but then it's also available for download and embed and streaming the next day. So check that out. Jeff is back with us tonight to talk tennis, and he's been on the show before, so we'll give him a huge introduction. But the former top 10 or former top junior tennis player, All American at Stanford, former ATP top 100 player. He has career wins over the likes of Marty Fish, David Nalbandian, among others. Now a high-performance coach, guest speaker, and a great guy to go to for tennis information. And check out everything Jeff has at JeffSolvesonTennis.com. And Jeff, you're the guys you had big wins over are starting to retire now. How does that make you feel?
Getting older, for sure. I hit the big 4-0 in October. But, you know, I like to think that 40 is the new 28. At least I think that in my dreams. And, yeah, I do notice, interestingly, some of them are retiring, but then some of them are still, you know, going strong. I mean, I beat Joe Willie Songo when he was 18 years old at the French Open in the qualies. He's still doing quite well. But you're right. A few of them are starting to shut it down. And that next generation, I don't know too many guys still playing. I mean, Mike Russell is like my best friend from the tour. He's about 85 years old, still playing, doing very well. And but yeah, a lot of these guys are almost done.
Now Mike says he's going to keep playing as long as he's in the top 100. But is also the rumors been going around this may be his last year. What does he tell you?
Actually, he told me the same thing a few months ago. But let me tell you something. If he's 120 in the world, he's probably still going to, you know, keep fighting the good fight. I think where he would be challenged is, like he said, if he's not in the main draw of the slams, and that would be top 104, you know, that's a minimum of $80,000 extra revenue just by playing in those four slams. And of course, the opportunity to win more points and have big wins. It's not that exciting to be 35 years old playing in Ecuador and Africa and Europe, crazy, you know, little towns in Europe and challengers trying to make it back to the ATP tour. So, you know, it'll probably naturally evolve where he might drop a little bit at some point, but you know what? He keeps proving us wrong as far as how long he can continue. I wouldn't be surprised if he can hover around 100 for a while.
Yeah, and it's fun. Like you said, it's not fun to play in those little events, but it's fun to play in Memphis and Atlanta and Washington and have a chance to play in Indian Wells and Cincinnati and those type of places. So it's hard to give up.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, the economics of the sport, if he's 120 or 130 in the world and he's not getting into the slams, it's about $80,000 less than he's making minimum a year. And there's a big, big difference between 120 and 100 in terms of revenue.
Those Tennis Express commercials pay okay, but I'm sure they don't play that well. So,
yeah, I think he's going to have to find a day job if he relies on that.
I like the one where he's in the hammock, though. But good to have you on, Jeff. You got
Thanks.
A lot going on. Your emails are always worth a read, and I enjoy getting them. And just kind of give the audience what you have currently going on, what you had going on, and
right.
What's coming up.
Well, for those that are listening for the first time, I started blogging in 2010, not knowing exactly what the heck I was doing. I knew I had a passion, and I wanted to share my knowledge and experience from playing days and from coaching. And so now we have Jeff Salzman's Team Tennis. We put out free video tips every single week. We put them on YouTube. We put them on the blog, and just trying to help people move forward with their tennis, whether they're a rec player, whether they're a professional, whether they're just kind of starting out. If you're a coach out there and you want to improve your coaching education, if you're a parent that wants to help your child get better at tennis, we provide, I feel, very common sense, forward thinking type tips that can help people get better. We also have products and services that we set, market, and sell as well. They're information courses. So essentially, people buy the courses and they get a login and password. And then they have these downloadable videos broken down into modules, learning modules. And those courses have been a huge hit as well. So I've really focused the last couple of years on being online instead of on the court. And I still teach a little bit, work with a few juniors. I am traveling around doing presentations and speaking engagements with various coaches and organizations, which keeps me busy. I love to travel, but my main passion is creating the videos and the content, both free and paid, to help people get better at tennis.
Yeah, I disagree with you on one thing, Jeff. I was reading your blog and following you back in 2010, and I think you didn't know what you were doing, but now you've refined it a little bit, and you've really led the way as far as technology and tennis and getting your message across through the internet.
Well, there are certainly others that started this concept before me, and I was able to look and see that they were having success, and I thought, boy, with my playing background, my passion, if I can learn the marketing side of things, I could actually make it a viable business, provide a lot of value to the tennis community, which I feel that I do. And the feedback that we get shows that that's happening. We just finished up a launch on the one hand backhand solution. So I got to practice my one hander while we created this course. That was a lot of fun. And we do send a lot of emails. We provide a lot of content. We also try to, trying to make a living at it over here. So, some people, they maybe think I email a little bit too much, but others love it. So I think when you get a lot of people really excited about what you're doing, and then you also have some people not so excited, it probably means you're actually doing something right. Because you can't make everybody happy. But certainly the goal is to try to provide a lot of value and help people get better at tennis.
Yes, yeah, sports and business is all about engaging people, and you definitely do that. So doing it, and you're doing a good job. Let's talk a little tennis here for a second.
Sure.
Australian Open in the rearview mirror now a little bit for about a month, and your predictions didn't pan out exactly right. And I don't know how many people had Stan Wawrinka winning.
I don't think anyone. I bet Stan probably didn't have it on his pool.
No, maybe his dog or his kid, maybe. But you look back on that and you see how a guy really got hot and everything just kind of fell into place for him. And he's a guy that's been close before in big matches, just never got over the edge. And it just kind of really shows if you get over the hump of maybe one big match like that, it can carry you through a tournament. And it just all the stars align for him that tournament.
Sure. Well, the Australian Open, especially on the men's side, the women's side as well, but the men's side was very, very interesting. I did predict Novak Djokovic to win. And, when you look at that match, again, Novak played his best match. Obviously, it could have gone either way. Certainly, the last game that he lost serve, I think it was at 30 all. He played a weird drop shot at 30-40. He chose to serve and volley and stone to, into the back fence. And I kept thinking, gosh, maybe because Boris Becker's in his box, he feels like serving and volleying on match point after playing for 5 hours. That was a very interesting, couple of minutes there. And you look at how close these tournaments are. If Novak plays more solid in that last game, he maybe ends up winning that match. And then if he got injured in the final, Novak might have won, that slam. So it's so fascinating how things can turn so quickly in a match and change the complexion of an entire tournament. In terms of Stan, I mean, I really have to attribute a lot of his success to his coach, Magnus Norman. I think Magnus Norman has already locked up coach of the year in my book, just by helping this kid and this adult win his first slam title. You look at Magnus Norman's track record on the grass at Wimbledon. He was coaching Soderling, or actually before that, at the French Open when he beat Nadal. So he obviously knows how to get to Nadal. He knows the style to play. He's helped Stan flatten out his forehand, hit his serve bigger, given him the confidence to beat the big guys. And I think they've also improved his fitness as well. So you bring that all together with his already world-class one-handed backhand, and now you've got a guy who's a real contender instead of a pretender at the end of slams.
Yeah, he won the big points. That made the difference. He's a guy that, at the big points previously, he's kind of gone away a little bit in Davis Cup and majors. So that was different to see, and hats off to him for winning that. And we'll see how he does the rest of the rest of the year when a player, Andres Gomez, was the one I remember. He won the Grand Slam tournament. He kind of went away after that. That was the highlight of his career. And the women's side, Marion Bartoli accomplished her goal, won Wimbledon, and she went away. We'll see how that plays out for him. So I don't think he's going anywhere just yet. So
not as long as Magnus Norman's in his corner.
No,
I mean, I think he's a stabilizing force. He's a workhorse. And, you know, I'm a big believer in getting world-class coaching. It's one of the things I talk about on my website, you know, whether someone wants to choose to work with me or not. But, you know, a mentor in business and life and relationships and tennis, it can make the difference between winning and losing. And people lose sight of how important having a great team and a great coach around you. And he's got that. Novak has had a great team around him for the last few years, although I don't really get that coaching situation with Boris Becker. I personally don't think that's going to make it throughout 2014. But again, I've been wrong many times before. Nadal obviously has a great team. And, you know, Federer has also had a very good team helping him along the way. And he's upgraded by, when I say upgraded, obviously Paul Anacone did a great job with him. But when I talk about upgrading, I mean, he got a guy who knows how to move forward, knows how to serve and volley, and someone that he obviously respects who's won many Grand Slams. And I was really impressed with what I saw from Roger in the Australian Open until the Nadal match. I was very surprised by that match in that he didn't execute the game style that I thought that he could against Nadal. It was almost like he reverted back to what he's used to doing. But up until that match, I saw signs and glimpses that Edberg had actually already had an impact on him, on his game, on his confidence. Federer is going to have a very good year.
I agree. And one other thing I like about you, Jeff, is you don't toe the company line when it comes to what the USTA believes and what traditional tennis thinkers have always preached throughout the years. You look at tennis as a sport that's evolving, and you've done things a little differently over the years. So I always give you credit for you know, looking past things. And I hope other people realize that as well. You're not a company man. I don't know what your current relationship with the USTA is and that type of thing, but keep doing what you're doing, and people are noticing.
Well, I get along great with a lot of people involved with the USTA. You know, I don't necessarily agree with how they're going about things. I would do things differently if I was certainly involved, and I would have that same conversation with Pat Mack or Jose if they asked me. You know, that's one of those things where a lot of people, they might not want to know what someone else thinks. But, you know, there's definitely some tweaks they can make. I know they're working hard. I know a lot of the coaches in the trenches there are working hard. It's almost a thankless job over there, because, you know, if you do well, then they say, well, of course. But if you aren't doing well, you're going to take a lot of heat from the private sector. So I do see both sides of it. And I think they are trying to do a better job of things. And I see that happening, but I think there are still some tweaks or major changes they could actually make.
One other group of tennis players that are kind of trotting around the country right now are the PowerShares Seniors Tour, the legends. You recently were able to attend it in Denver there. And we've all been to the tennis exhibitions and that type of thing, but when you were there, did you find it mostly to be just tennis entertainment, or were people able to learn some things from these legends of the sport?
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, Denver is a major league city. I mean, Broncos got to the Super Bowl. You know, we won't talk about what happened.
Your prediction was wrong on that too, Jeff.
But they did get to the Super Bowl and had a fabulous season. You know, the Avalanche, we've got the Avalanche, we've got the Rockies, we've got the Nuggets. Okay, they're not all doing great, but, you know, we're a major league city, but we don't have major league tennis. And to be able to bring Blake and Roddick and Courier and Philippoussis in on one night and play for 3 hours in front of our tennis community, it's a big lift for us. You know, we have Denver there. They play very good tennis. We don't have a men's program up at CU. So when those, it's a big night for us. You know, obviously I'd love to see bigger attendance. But you know, it's kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, tennis isn't really considered a major sport in the real world these days. Unfortunately, all of us tennis lovers would like to see it differently, but a couple of takeaways that I had from PowerShares. Number one, even though Jim Courier didn't win his match, he's still fit as a fiddle, and he makes that PowerShares go by, you know, probably getting all these guys together and making it happen. Roddick and Blake, I think it's funny, you know, when I used to think of like the Champions Tour when I was a kid, you know, I'm thinking these guys are well north of 35, maybe 40, 45. And I'm looking at Andy Roddick, he's 31, 32, and Blake's 33. And, you know, they're a good 6 to 7 to 8 years younger than I am. And I'm just shaking my head like these guys should still be on the pro tour. Like Tommy Haas is 35, still playing. These guys are on the Champions Tour. So that was kind of funny. You know, Roddick obviously has a huge serve. I think he's a little banged up in the shoulder. He hasn't been playing much, but you know, with the altitude, the ball was bouncing and kicking up. He won the event. But overall, it was an entertainment evening of tennis. They're pretty serious about it. I mean, these guys want to win. They're competitive. But just because, you know, it's a one night deal, they're a little bit more lighthearted. They can joke with each other. But at the end of the day, they all are competing out there and they do want to win.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes down to it, they'll play to win. Yeah, I think it's there's a place for it. And like you said, a market like yours, it was great. It was in Salt Lake City last night and they got some good press there. So
who won in Salt Lake last night?
Blake.
Okay, so Blake, the next night they went to Houston and Blake, Agassi beat Blake. So Blake's been doing well. He got to the finals and lost to Roddick in Denver. So good for him.
Yeah, he should do well in that. He's fresh off the tour. So
that's true.
So let's give him some credit for that. And Indian Wells coming up starting next week, qualifying starting here in a couple days. What do you think is going to happen out there? No Williams sisters, and I know you're focusing mostly on the guys, but. What do you think?
Obviously, I'd like to see how Lee Na does. I mean, she obviously had a favorable draw in Australia, but regardless of that fact, she still had to win 7 matches, and she almost lost one of her matches earlier in the tournament. So I'd like to see how well she does. The young Canadian Jeannie Bouchard, you know, she's the rising star. And Nick Saviano has done one heck of a job with her. Building that foundation, got to give him a lot of credit. I'd like to see how Sloane Stephens does. I mean, she's picked up Paul Anacone this year, and you know, like to see her make a run out there in the desert. On the men's side, of course, we mentioned Stan and we mentioned Federer. I'd really like to see how they back up their nice showings in Australia. And you know, you've got Nadal. And Nadal and Djokovic as the bookends. I mean, they're just almost the stabilizing forces of tennis. You know, Murray got hurt. Del Potro's banged up right now. Federer's been in and out the last year. But Nadal and Djokovic have clearly been the two best players in the world the last year. And so they probably are going to Indian Wells. And if they play Miami, looking to reassert their dominance over the rest of the crew. So it's going to be interesting. Guys coming back from injuries, guys playing better. We'll see what happens, but I really believe it's going to be an interesting year. And more guys probably on the men's side probably believe they can beat the top guys than ever before. So I think you could see more upsets this year at Indian Wells and throughout the 2014 season.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch. And we're with Jeff Salzenstein from JeffSalzensteinTennis.com. Let's take a quick break here for Amazon.com. If you're doing any shopping here in the next month or two, we have Mother's and Father's Day coming up, graduations. You can use the studio link at Amazon, netcaststudio.com/Amazon for any and all of your needs. No extra cost to you. Help support the studio here and the shows that it brings. So netcaststudio.com/Amazon. So I feel free to use that. I used it the other day. And everyone's doing shopping on Amazon, so it's simple to use. So Jeff, a little technology talk here now. I've tried out a couple of these products, and a couple more sensors are coming. Tennis rackets with an embedded chip or a sensor in them that gives you instant feedback. It's been big in golf as far as swing analysis. How do you think that this will fare in the world of tennis?
Oh, I think it's a great technology. I mean, I would love to try it myself. I haven't personally, but you know, any time where you can advance tennis or golf, for that matter, in a way that the customer, the consumer, feels more engaged, they get more real data. I think that's a positive thing. So it's only moving in the right direction when it comes to those types of concepts, and you know, it gives again more valuable feedback to the consumer and to the coach. Probably the being the devil's advocate, the one side, is it going to be measuring racket head speeds, concepts like that?
Well, the ones I've seen, yes. And the one that I have here in my possession, it doesn't give you the exact racket head speed, but it gives you a chart or a diagram that lets you know how your racket head speed went up and down during the match. And it's no surprise that at the end of a long three setter, your racket's head speed and your power goes down.
So, yeah, that's fantastic, because at the end of a match, when you see that data, it kind of can kind of kick you in the butt a little bit that you might need to get in better shape, you know? And yeah, so and I think it, getting that also, real-time data is great.
And it also, I don't know how it does this, it also lets you know when you're hitting the ball flat, when you're hitting topspin, and when you're hitting slice. And I've noticed on a few of the ones I've charted, again, in that third set, the person, the topspin, number of topspin shots went way down, and they started slicing things, probably because they started getting fatigued.
Yeah, that's true. As I was saying, the devil's advocate part would be if it did measure racket head speed, I think, you know, maybe some people would try to swing too fast if they saw that their racket head speed was too low. And that's not necessarily the best thing to do for a rec player. But these other trends sound very promising. And yeah, it'll be exciting. It's also one of those things where, again, other people, you know, other companies might struggle a little bit if they don't keep up with the technology, those that are staying on the forefront. I know Babolat's been a leader. Sounds like other rackets are getting involved with this concept as well. So that could be the major trend of the tennis racket future here.
Yeah, the ones with the chip that's embedded into the racket, they're a little, the cost on those is a little out there. Wilson's coming, like you said, Babolat's got one right now. Wilson's coming with one. Head's coming with one. And then I have these little chips that you attach to the butt of the racket, or there's a little a little net that attaches, that slides onto the butt of the racket, and the chip is in that little netting thing. I think those are pretty cool. You can use your normal racket and still measure the racket speed and that type of thing. I have one from a company called Zepp, Z-E-P-P,
okay.
And it actually is pretty cool how it does it, and it's scary accurate. So,
wow.
I give it some credit, and this is a first version. This is a 1.0. They said they're going to keep getting better with this, and the 1.0 is pretty useful. So you would use this, Jeff, with maybe someone you're coaching in practice or in a simulated match, just to kind of get some data?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the more data, you know, that I can get, the better. And then I, you know, as a coach, I'll be able to use I'll use the information that I want that's going to work for me. You know, there's some other technologies coming out where players can get on a court in specific clubs now, and they're putting them in different clubs where you can play a tournament match or a practice match, and literally you come off the court and you can get all of the statistics that you need, like where someone served on a break point or where you hit your shots in certain situations, or you could see all of your backhand cross courts. So that type of technology is starting to come out as well. So, you know, people are getting this, you know, real-time data that actually, I believe, increases in accountability. You know, it helps the coach, because if a player sees that they're serving to a certain place on game point and they're going there too often, they're going to get that statistic and they're going to learn faster and be more motivated because they have this information, instead of the coach just saying, hey, you're serving down to this area too much, you need to serve over there. It might not go in that ear and stay in the ear as much as it would if you can actually look at a full report. So a lot of exciting things on the horizon in our sport.
Yeah, I think that for a college team, a high school team, 18 and under, I think that is really information that is great. But Jeff, if you were coaching a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old, would you present him with that data where you're serving, you know, on tee or wide at certain times? Or are you worried with a junior player at that age about other things at that point in time?
You know, it really depends on how much time you get to spend with a student. You know, I've had a fun situation this year where I'm working with a player that I've known since she was 10 years old. And you ask a great question. When she was 12, she probably didn't have the maturity to really take in a lot of the deeper knowledge that I can share. And now at 16 years old, you know, she plays a lot of practice sets, and I'll stand behind her and basically give her my brain. You know, I'll talk to her. Okay, it's 30-40. This girl's going to serve down the tee. Take away the tee serve here. Do not get ace down the tee. And these are things that she would never be thinking about, right? You're right. I mean, a certain age at 12 years old, those statistics might not be as relevant. As a coach, your job is to extract the most important information and knowing your player's personality. Do they want to know the stats, or do they only want to know one or two things? Same with a pro player. You know, you're probably not going to give a pro player, you know, a 20-page report on their last match. As a coach, you're going to look at the report, you're going to pick out two or three takeaways, and you're going to make sure that player is clear on their game plan based on what you learned in a previous match that they played, certain patterns and trends, and just make sure they're very clear with their game plan going into the match.
Yeah, excellent point. And Jeff, you brought up one other interesting thing. You said you stand behind her when she's playing a practice match.
Yep.
I've contended for years, my favorite seats when I go to watch a pro tournament are in the end. Sit at the end, behind the baseline, and watch how the players move, watch the ball move. I think you miss a lot of that when you're sitting in the 50-yard line seats at a tennis match. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I move around. I mean, I go side, I go to the back, but especially, yeah, you're right. In this case, if I can stand behind a player, and a lot of times, I'm not shy. I won't stand in the, some coaches are in the corner. I literally stand right behind her while she's returning. So she's in the deuce court, I'm standing behind her. When she goes to the ad court, I walk with her and stand behind her, or at least shade a little bit over towards the middle. But I want to get a real nice look at what she's seeing and what choices she's making. And then as soon as that point is over, I have to decide, am I going to make a comment? Am I going to make a correction? A lot of times I'll walk up to her and I'll show her a shadow stroke or a technique, or I'll talk to her. And other times I won't say anything for 30 minutes because I'm just kind of feeling out what she needs at that time. Sometimes I want her to have independence. Sometimes I'm just going to be every point giving her my brain, how my mind is thinking. And oftentimes it's much different than what a teenager is thinking about on the court. So, if I could have her 4 or 5 times a week, over the course of a year or 2 years, she'd become a pretty smart tennis player. We only have, once a week if we're lucky. So I try to cram it all in. But that's where a lot of the learning can happen. As you said, standing behind and really seeing how she sees the court, patterns that she needs to put together instead of just standing on the sideline.
Yeah, and when you go to a professional tournament, if you're behind the action, you get a whole different perspective of, and I think a better appreciation of how hard these guys are hitting the ball, how much spin they're putting on it, and how well they're moving. So it's
absolutely
just something to think about. But Jeff, I mentioned we were going to talk about some predictions for 2014, but people can go on your website, jeffsalvesteintennis.com, and see your predictions for 2014. I just wanted to mention 2 points out of that.
Yes.
One you mentioned, one of your predictions, the players that have a team or a strong support staff behind them have a big advantage over someone that maybe doesn't, or doesn't even travel with a coach, or just travels with a coach at the big tournament. That, in this day and age, that's become a big edge, almost, to the point of, and you can't say it's unfair, but it's a big advantage.
Oh, I will say it's unfair. I, as you said, I don't toe the party line, but when you look at the top 4 guys in the world, 5 guys in the world, they're traveling with a minimum of 4 to 5 people every week, and they can afford to take weeks off. They're making, lots of money to piss. And then you've got a guy, one of my 200 in the world, his name is James McGee. He's at his career high ranking. He's 26 years old. He's never been able to afford a coach. You take James McGee and you give him 5 people, stretching him, working with him, doing his travel, being his agent, getting him deals, picking his schedule, helping him with, you give him 5, people around him, and 3 or 4 years of that, and he's top 50 in the world. Easy. Like, it's not even, it's not even a question. The guy has so much ability, but it's so difficult if you're 120, 150, 200 in the world to even get to that top 10 level or top 20 level, because it's like running a business. Try running a business alone. It's almost impossible. You need employees. You need people helping you with things that you're not good at.
Advisors, counselors, that type of thing.
Yeah, and a lot of these players out here are trying to do it on their own, running their own business on their own. It's very challenging. And obviously, certain players, they elevate, they get to the top 50, and maybe they can afford a coach or a trainer, and then they get to the top 30 and they add another person. But it is, the economics of the sport don't make sense. I mean, again, you look at the NBA and the NFL, they all have their own teams. They all have their trainers and coaches, and everything is staffed and taken care of for the players. Whether you're the Peyton Manning or whether you're the 55th man on the team, you're still well taken care of. And in tennis, it's not that way. So it's very difficult for someone who's, I had it happen to me. I didn't have a coach travel with me full time. And I think I would have done a lot better. And so I look at a lot of players out there that have immense talent, they don't even get to 200 in the world. They're great players, but they don't even have the resources to get out of the futures. Sure. So it's unfortunate. I mean, I think that our sport has a lot of positives, but one of the downsides is that economically it's not a good business model. I mean, it just isn't, unless you're in the top 20, 30 in the world.
I don't know if you saw the news today, Jeff, that broke, but the ATP is considering doing something similar to what goes on in the WTA tour and allowing one time each set a coach to come down onto the court and mic the coach for the TV and talk to the male player. Now, I don't know how you feel about that, because I'm sure the TV networks are behind this, because that sometimes turns into pretty compelling television.
Right.
And again, like they said, there's, you know, even that ATP 250 events, there's, you know, players that don't travel with a coach, and who are they going to pick up to come and talk to them, you know, the sideline, a doubles partner or something like that, versus, you know, if you have, you know, Paul Anacone come down and talk to you.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think they should spend more time figuring out how to increase prize money in the challengers and increase prize money for these other players so that they can actually afford to travel, or at least afford to have a coach, even if it's 10 weeks a year, you know? And so I think they should focus their energy more on that instead of, you know, a coaching timeout once per set to add more excitement. Let's get the players that are, you know, 120, 150, 200 in the world a lot more money so they can actually travel and play.
Yeah, good point. And before, one more thing before our last question, the debacle with the U.S. Davis Cup team and the women's Fed Cup team in the last month, how they couldn't get out of a first round. And what's your take on that?
Well, my take is, I love the Bryans. I love Jim Courier. I like John Isner, Sam Querrey. But I didn't agree with the court surface choice. I feel like the decision, they were thinking more about how to make Great Britain uncomfortable instead of focusing on what we do well. So I think in tennis, even when game planning in a match, I used to, you know, when I was on the tour, I'd walk up to a guy, they'd say, "Oh, who do you play tomorrow?" And they would say, "I play Joe Smith." And they would say, "Oh, he's got a weak forehand. Play his forehand." Well, the problem is that my backhand was my weaker shot. And so if I play backhand, I'm a lefty, backhand cross court to the righty's forehand. That's not actually a pattern that I want to be in. So a lot of times people would give me advice on how to play a player instead of just focusing on, "Hey, Jeff, you've got a big serve and a big forehand. Use your athleticism, move forward, be aggressive, play to your strengths." And I think that the Davis Cup team, maybe they'll do it next time around, should focus more on their strengths and what they do really, really well. And obviously the Bryans are great on red clay, but that's only one point. And I think that we should play every match probably on a high bouncing, medium paced hard court every time, because that's just Isner, Querrey, Donald Young, Jack Sock. I mean, all of us grew up on hard courts. That's where we should be focusing our energies. So I think we definitely out analyze that one, in my opinion. And then with Isner going down, I think Sock wasn't available, and then Young was the next highest guy. He might maybe won a round at the Australian Open. And, you know, that's a lot to ask. That's a big ask to put him in his first tie on red clay, you know, to be able to come away with a win. So the whole thing was a bit of a debacle. And the Fed Cup, you know, again, you know, very interesting that they can't get the top players, and that, you know, the younger ones weren't able to pull their weight. But, you know, the Italians, even though they had a lot of their backups, they seem to be more polished, especially when it comes to international competition.
Whose fault is that, Jeff? Is it just whoever makes a decision on the surfaces? Or
whose fault is what? The Davis Cup?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, when something like that happens, no one ever wants to take the blame. And I don't know if you saw, you might want to go on the Salt Lake City newspaper website today. Jim Courier makes some statements about Davis Cup, saying, "Yeah, I know Davis Cup now is so far out of the realm of the sports fan, and, you know, it was a nice little venue, but that's about it, because Davis Cup, he's not surprised people don't show up and don't watch it." That's kind of and have the captain saying things like that, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but I can tell you, I have a few inside sources that Bob and Mike had a strong influence on the choosing the chord surface. And, you know, again, I love these guys. They're like my brothers. And they chose the ball, and then Jim obviously has a lot of respect for Mike and Bob, and so I think they all collaborated and felt like that was the best surface for them to win. They'd have a guaranteed doubles point, and they felt like Isner would be able to win on clay. But again, you're not really considering Sam Querrey playing on clay. And yes, it was a bit of an upset, but you know, I think they missed it. I mean, I think they just missed it. I think the Bryans were probably thinking again more about how could they get their point, at least that one point. So they know they got one in the bag, and, you know, Isner would carry the torch in the singles. So, it's a bit of a mystery. And, one of those things where, you know, those guys are going to defend, they're still going to defend that choice. But most people on the outside are looking at it going, boy, that was a curious one.
Absolutely. Jeff, just kind of as we wrap up here, give the listeners your website information, how they can contact you on social media, and anything else you want to promote here.
Sure. Jeff Salzenstein Tennis. Hopefully some people can spell my name. If they can, it's Salzenstein. JeffSalzensteinTennis.com. We put out fun tennis tips every week. You can get on my email list, and I'll email you inspiring stories from the road, motivate you, and educate you on what I think how you can get better at tennis, regardless of your level. Really excited about sharing that information and kind of the inside, behind the scenes stories about what I'm learning as a coach and what I experienced as a player. And always a pleasure to come on the show with you, Rick. And thanks for asking me tonight. I'm excited for this coming season to watch some great tennis ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking. Here's Jim Courier's exact quote. Davis Cup competition does not work in America as far as hitting the radar screen. Hopefully the owners of the Davis Cup, his opinion, will make the switch and give it the status that a Ryder Cup or a President's Cup has. He said, basically, for right now, it's a nice event when we play it in a nice place like San Diego.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's referring to is this year-long concept that maybe he wants it, you know, 1 week, all the countries come together to play. And, you know, I get that. I understand that concept. At the same time, if we had Agassi, Sampras, Chang, and Courier on the Davis Cup team, all in the top 10 in the world, and we were getting to the finals and the semis every year, I think it would be on a lot of people's radars. We just don't have a good team.
Maybe we should get a captain that likes the current format and for one that doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you do, like you said, is instead of focusing on that, you say, how the heck do we play on our best surface? How the heck do we get our players healthy and ready to play their best? And let's focus all our energies on developing these players and getting them to a higher level and a higher standard, not on the system being broken.
Yeah, and Davis so Davis Cup can be a great event, and
I think so too.
It was in the past, and right now in the U.S. it isn't. So
yeah, I mean, if we were getting to the semis and the finals, it would be on the radar, and ESPN would carry it in the finals, and you'd have sold out crowds. But you know, when you're also, you know, I don't know all the details here, but I think the USTA charges a pretty penny for tickets to these events. And, you know, it's almost a 3-day package deal. I don't know if it's $250 or $500, but that's pretty expensive for the consumer out there, especially when it's just a one-off in your city, you know, once every 20 years. So, you know, they might want to look at if they reduce prices and change their marketing strategies. You know, I'll be happy to talk to them about email marketing if they want help with that. Not that I'm a complete expert, but I've learned a few things in that world. But I think that if you provided more free tickets, cheaper tickets, family discounts, bonuses, you might even fill those seats.
Yeah, and one other little breaking. We'll talk about it off the air here in a second. Jeff, okay. last question. Anything new technology-wise you're using with your students right now that in the last few months, or anything new that you've seen?
Technology. Well, again, I'm not doing a lot of teaching, to be completely transparent with you. But
any good emailing programs you're using?
Yeah. Well, in terms of technology, I mean, this is going to sound a little bit woo woo, but you know, I just went to a meditation workshop last week, And they talk a lot about not just, you know, chanting or, you know, breathing and thinking of nothing, but really if you understand how to visualize and you understand how to quote unquote get in the zone, and you can do that through visualization, through certain types of breathing and just really seeing what you want in your life and in your tennis, it starts to create that reality can be created. And so when I look at the best players in the world, I really believe they're doing it naturally. They see where they want the ball to go. They see themselves winning Wimbledon, the French Open. And so when you talk about technology, let's go old school, the technology of the mind, yep. Especially these junior players that are on their cell phones, you know, 20 hours a day and playing Xbox. Let's get them off the cell phones, off the Xbox, off the TV, and have them actually train their mind to be champions. And so that is the technology that I'm going to promote, is to focus more on visualization and mindset and believing in yourself. And that's how we can start to build a foundation to create better tennis players.
That's good to hear. And actually, that holds true for any sport, I believe. I actually talked to a supercross racer a couple weeks ago, and in tennis, it's called the zone. He calls it the feel. And he says, when I have the feel, that means I can take any jump, I can take any turn, and I have no worry that I'm going to crash or something bad is going to happen to me. So I think that's really great you brought that up, and I think that holds true for any sport.
Yep, the technology of the mind. We're going to run with that one.
Absolutely. Good job, Jeff. Appreciate you coming on, and just hold on for a second as we wrap up. Just want to let listeners know that they can check out everything NetCast Studio has to offer at netcaststudio.com. And the podcast directly set up by the people here at NetCast Studio is called Two Thumbs Up Media, twothumbsupmedia.com. You can discover new shows and content right at your fingertips on there. That's really worth checking out, and new shows being added all the time. So thanks to Jeff, and thanks for listening. You can listen to The Tech of Sports on NetCast Studio Productions.